I'm Marty Moscoe-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. 11 people were killed and 6 were injured at Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh on Saturday. The alleged shooter reportedly shouting, "All Jews must die," before opening fire. He's scheduled to appear in court today. This was after a week when 14 pipe bombs were mailed to prominent Democrats, including President Obama, party supporter George Soros, and CNN. And lost in all that coverage was the shooting of 2 African-American shoppers at a grocery store after the alleged killer apparently tried to enter a black church but couldn't open the door. While the men arrested did not know each other, they appear to be inspired by deep-seated hatred fueled in part by vicious conspiracy theories on social media and fear-mongering in our politics. It's been a grim and dispiriting week in this country, not the first time we've had to grapple with mass violence and political threats. Is this the country we want to be? You can join our conversation, 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me introduce our 3 guests. Nancy Baron-Bear is Regional Director of the Anti-Defamation League. Nancy, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Emile Bruneau is the Director of the Peace and Conflict Neuroscience Lab that's at the Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Pennsylvania, lead scientist of the Beyond Conflict Innovation Lab. Emile, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Great to be here.
And joining us from Chicago is Christian Piccolini. He's a former extremist, helped to create several organizations that counter violence, violent extremism, including Life After Hate and the Free Radicals Project. He's also the author of a memoir titled White American Youth, My Descent into America's Most Violent Hate Movement and How I Got Out. We posted his TED Talk on our Facebook page. And Christian, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
It's good to be here. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Nancy, let me begin with you. As a Jew, do you feel safe today?
That's a tough question, because I'm not sure in their hearts that Jews and non-Jews feel safe today. I don't think it's just the Jewish people that feel a different kind of feeling. If you can't go to a synagogue, a place of contemplation, a place that's supposed to be a peace and quiet, to have a service, if you can't do that, where are we today?
Well, I'm thinking of other mass murders at churches, one in Charleston, in Texas, for instance. How about for you, Emile? What are your thoughts today?
Well, of course, there's a deep tragedy, and it brings it right in front of us when we're here in Pennsylvania, when it's in your state. But this is my research. I do research on intergroup conflict and the forces that drive people to hatred and to violence, and this is nothing new. Certainly, we've seen elements of this all across Europe and in South Africa. So this white supremacy in particular has been a persistent tide.
I want to pick up on that, the global perspective. Christian, let me get you in on the conversation. Is this our new normal?
You know, it's a trend that is very disturbing at the moment. This goes back many, many decades and even hundreds of years to incidents of white supremacy that have gone into places of faith to murder people, from the Sikh temple in Oak Creek, Wisconsin, right, to Charleston, and to what happened now in Pittsburgh. This is a trend. This is something that is not an anomaly or something that's on the fringe. It's something that is happening as a part of our society. And it's time that we have to understand and figure out what it is that we want to be as a country going forward. And I think that this is a watershed moment for us to make a decision.
I agree with that. And I do want to pick up on that. Nancy, let me go back to you. We were talking before going on the air about Tree of Life Synagogue. This is a synagogue literally in Mr. Rogers' neighborhood. Apparently, he lived just a couple of blocks,
yes,
from this synagogue. And you were saying that they had some kind of training a couple of weeks ago in case something like this happened.
Yes, ADL and other groups provide security training for religious institutions. In fact, there's one upcoming, and I want to announce that here, November 13th for all religious institutions at the Constitution Center. They can go and go to our website, and they can sign up for that. This was pre-planned before all of this. However, I think that Jews in particular have felt a fear, a hesitancy. And so they have done security trainings for years and years. Members know to be careful about who they let in behind them. Synagogues don't anymore have all their doors open, very sadly. There's often a one-door entrance. Preschool children know what they have to do in case there's an active shooter. These are different times.
Help us understand, and I'm going to turn both to you, Emil, but also to you, Christian, as well. And there are a number of reasons we wanted you both here was to help us understand some of the psychology that we're dealing with. Emil, as you said, this is, in a sense, your area of expertise.
Yeah, well, one of the basic elements of psychology here is this tendency to think in terms of us and them, right? This tribal viewpoint. And this is prevalent. It's kind of part of who we are. But deciding who is us and who is them,
right,
that's pretty flexible in humans. And this is how something like racism comes about, because children aren't born racist, right? They have to learn that. One-year-olds, three-year-olds don't have a preference for black over white. They don't really understand it as a characteristic. So we as a society have to diligently teach our children specifically who to hate. And so this is one element of it. And then once that's established, then all sorts of other psychological processes come online, like dehumanization.
Why do we hate people we don't know, though, that we've never met?
Well, because they're part of a group. This is the flexibility of the human mind. Once they're defined as part of the group, then they take on the characteristics of a group, not an individual. Right? And so you can transfer your hatred from one person in the group to the other person. They're interchangeable with each other. And this is how we can harm, how someone can shoot a Muslim cab driver in New York City because of an event that happened by Muslim extremists in Paris. Right, the ability to think in terms of groups is something that is pernicious in humans.
Christian, you've both been a member of hate groups, in fact, a leader of a hate group, but also work to get people out of those kinds of groups. Help us understand the thinking, the mindset that can lead to this level of violence.
You know, in my experience, having worked with hundreds of people, hundreds of extremists from various groups, the pre-radicalization stage starts essentially the day they're born. The ideology, when it appears in front of them, is just the license, the permission slip to be angry, to act out against their grievances, or I call them potholes, those things that appear in their life that deviate their trajectory and push them towards these fringes. And once they're there, Emil's right, they're given this narrative that's very black and white, that everybody who belongs to a certain group is the one causing their pain. And because they've felt marginalized, there are certain subset of individuals within these movements who have the proclivity to be violent.
In fact, you've talked about your own, I guess, vulnerability, your difficulties dealing with your own life and what this particular hate group offered you.
For me, having been a child of Italian immigrants who came to the U.S. in the mid-60s and certainly was surrounded by a lot of love, I felt very abandoned as a young child because my parents had to work to support themselves and the family 7 days a week, 14 hours a day. So even though I was, surrounded by all the things that I needed to have a positive outcome, there was still something missing, and what they gave me was a sense of identity, community, and purpose. At 14 years old in 1987, when I was, very vulnerable to a message, the recruiter saw in me this need, this vulnerability, and he did deliver identity, community, and purpose, certainly with a message and the meaning that, was meant to hurt people.
Emil's, Christian has said that fear is the father of hatred. Based on your work, your research, does that make sense to you?
Yeah, I think it even can go beyond hatred, too. It can go to a cold calculation, right? That, I think hatred is certainly a strong motivation to harm others, but from what a lot of I've heard of the motivations of the killers in this last week, a lot of it seems to be motivated by trying to help their own group. Right? So this is we tend to take comfort in the fact that we think that they are sociopaths, that there's something different about them, that they lack empathy. But I think, the reality is oftentimes that In a way, empathy is what motivates them. It's just that their empathy is so dramatically distributed differently between their own group and the other group. So they lack empathy for the other group, but empathy might be a motivation for fighting on behalf of their group.
Kristen, let me get a response from you. Does that make sense to you? And then, Nancy, I'll go back to you.
You know, it does, because when I was involved, I certainly didn't think I was doing anything bad. I thought I was saving the world. And that's the mindset, is once they've painted the enemy, the them or the other, it dehumanizes them and demonizes them. So it's easy for adherents to think that they're subhuman or you know, less than human to be able to commit these types of acts.
Nancy, let me go back to you. And in terms of understanding anti-Semitism, when someone shouts, "All Jews must die," we can completely understand what that is. But there are dog whistles. There are things that people do and say that don't have that kind of overt anti-Semitism, but the message is the same. Can you speak to that?
Yes. There's in our society today, sadly, there are some grave, grave misunderstandings about Jewish people. There are theories that, in fact, and this is something that led Bowers to do what he did, we believe, that Jews after World War II were very big in the pro-immigration movement, that they urged Congress to make laws to make it more open. And to him, anyone who comes in from many of the countries would be non-white. Jews are considered non-white, too. And so, therefore, if we're pushing for immigration, then we're pushing his button, so to speak. That's one of the very big ones. And on top of that, today when we see things about George Soros and other individuals, it's the theory misplaced that Jews are powerful. Jews control the media. Things like that that we hear over and over from people in the white supremacist movement and others.
Kristen, about a minute before our break here, but is that when you were a member of one of these hate groups, did that language mean something to you?
Well, the ideology is driven almost exclusively by conspiracy theory, and certainly the George Soros conspiracy is one that is prominent today. You know, it all really comes back to early 1900s, pre-World War I in Tsarist Russia, when they published a book called The Protocols of the Elders of Zion, which is a fraudulent document that was supposedly leaked from a meeting of global Jewish leaders to discuss controlling the world. And that's still today, even though it's been debunked and it is totally fraudulent, is still the most influential book to white supremacists and also to Islamists in the Middle East, and is still accepted as truth by many in these movements.
Let's take that short break and we'll get back to our conversation. Again, that's Christian Piccellini, and he is the co-founder of a couple of groups, including Life After Hate and the Free Radicals Project, to help counter violent extremism. And he was an extremist, a white supremacist himself. Emile Bruneau from the Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Pennsylvania, director of the Peace and Conflict Neuroscience Lab, and Nancy Baron-Bear, regional director of the Anti-Defamation League. 1-888-477-9499. Much more after the short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. We are talking about, frankly, what most everyone in this country is talking about today. And, of course, that's the massacre at the synagogue in Pittsburgh yesterday. And this came on the heels of pipe bombs sent to something like 14 prominent Democrats, including former President Obama. And also the two African-Americans were gunned down in a supermarket by a shooter who reportedly tried to get inside a black church but was unable to do that. Emile, let me go back to you, and something that you have found is you looked at some data, found that Americans think that, and this is Americans, think that 25% of the refugees at our southern border are gang members, and that Americans think that 35% of the children at the southern border are being used as props to gain entry. Fact check that for us.
Well, so I the interesting thing to me is that this isn't just a conservative response, that Democrats and Republicans are pretty close to each other in their responses. So Democrats and Republicans are off by about twofold. But those estimates are about 300-fold greater than reality, that in reality, from Department of Homeland Security statistics, right, from Trump administration statistics, about 0.2% of the migrants.
Less than 1%.
Less than 1% of the migrants coming to our southern border are in any way affiliated with a gang. And less than 0.1% of the children are even suspected of being used as props to gain entry by adults. So Americans are overestimating that 300-fold, and Democrats and Republicans are much closer to each other than they are to the truth. And I think that, you know, the sobering reality of this is that, yes, certainly conspiracy theories are driving white supremacists to do these terrible acts, but we have narratives in mainstream society that are surprisingly in line with their conspiracy theories. So there's seep to the other.
There's seep from one to the other. Do you see it that way, Christian? And you had mentioned 100 years ago. We should say that 100 years ago, the KKK marched openly in Washington, D.C. And we're seeing racists and anti-Semites, they're not hiding under sheets. They're out there in the open and demonstrating and saying Jews will not replace us. Are we dealing with a more overt and open and maybe even normal and accepted form of if not anti-Semitism, racism, and we can add homophobia?
Well, I think that these are things that have always existed, sadly, in our country. But certainly over the last 30 years from when I was involved in that movement, there was a strategy to normalize the ideology, to blend in. We recognized that shaved heads and boots and swastika tattoos were turning away the average American white racist. So we knew we needed to blend in. We needed to look like the people we wanted to recruit and sound like them. So we started to take the message and make it more palatable for people to swallow. And I think that that's what we're seeing today seep into society and into, you know, both the Democrats and the Republicans sometimes believing some of these conspiracy theories. And that was a concerted effort 30 years ago to move from boots to suits. We even encouraged people to get jobs in law enforcement, to become teachers, to go to the military and get training, and then, you know, if they had a clean record, to eventually run for office.
I mean, that sounds even more dangerous when, you know, the KKK was marauding in the South.
It absolutely is, because the strategy is one of leaderless resistance. It's less about the group structure these days and more about just adherence to the movement and being a lone wolf. And, you know, while this movement today is worried about optics, you know, I've been looking in on a lot of their chats and their platforms, and you know, while they're not denouncing what happened, they're worried about how it may make them look.
Oh, really? Bad for their brand?
Mm-hmm. Bad for their brand. I mean, I think that the way of thinking is they have somebody in power now, and they don't have to necessarily do these things because they feel they have the power to control policy and to make sweeping changes that way. So, you know, but again, there are always a small subset of people who are going to be violent regardless of what everybody else feels.
You're nodding your head, Nancy.
Oh, on a number of different points. I think that one of the things we must discuss is the internet, because the truth of the matter is, while people might have been marching in white sheets, they could only reach the people who were right in front of them. Today, you can sit on a white sheet in your bedroom, be on your computer, and you can, by a button, hit millions of people. And because you're faceless and nameless, there's no shame. There's no reason for you to tell the truth. There's no consequences. And that, in fact, has affected much of society. You can see it in the all kinds of tweets. We did research between January of 17 and January of 18 and found that there were over 4.2 million anti-Semitic tweets going back and forth.
Emil, it sounds like you want to say something, Christian. Go ahead.
Yeah, and I just wanted to add to that, you know, some of the tactics that they're using online specifically for recruitment are that they're going to traditional safe zones, things like online gaming forums or forums dedicated to depression or autism, where they know there may be vulnerable people there who are seeking community, seeking purpose and identity, and may not have relationships in real life. And they're starting to really poison them with these narratives and memes that desensitize them to things like the Holocaust. And you know, they're talking to our young kids over headsets while they're playing multiplayer games. It's very disturbing what's happening.
Emil, go ahead.
Yeah, I think one of the difficult things that this sets up is once you have people bought into an extremist ideology like this, you don't have to give them directions, right? This is what Alex Haslam calls creative followership. People can come up with their own interpretations of what should be done to further this ideology. And I think that's what we see, right? And that's very difficult to, you know, it's difficult to prove where the influence really came from. And it gives this impression of a lone wolf. But, you know, this is not a mistake. This is designed, right? This is, as Christian is saying, this is a deliberate strategy.
I want to pick up on the empathy comment that you said, which is to say that it's not necessarily a lack of empathy on the part of some of these hate mongers, but a over-identification, I guess, with their own particular group, so a greater sense of empathy for themselves and their group?
Yeah, this is very common. So once you have the social identity can be a wonderful thing, right? And we all crave it. But once you've established that social identity, if you can identify someone who's threatening that social group, your group, then your caring for your group can motivate you to harm whoever's threatening it. And certainly we saw the precursor of this in Hungary, right? Hungary, a lot of the same things we see in our government today were in Hungary a few years before, right? It's kind of like style. It's filtered over here after a few years. But, you know, for Hungary, the elections, their slogan was "Make Hungary Great Again." Yeah. They had billboards all over the country that said, if you come to our country, you can't, you know, take our jobs, you can't change our culture. But these are all written in Hungarian, right? So these are billboards put up by the government specifically directed at the Hungarian population. Hungary came up with the Skittles analogy. So all of these things, you know, they're not new. We're recycling them from other places.
Christian, let me go back to you. How then do you, and you have talked to people, and you were one of these people, can you talk someone out of their hatred and white supremacy? Is it a matter of giving them the facts and hoping that the facts will convince someone that they're wrong?
Unfortunately, we're living in a time when truth and facts are debatable. And, I never lead with that. I never argue with anybody. I never try to debate to change their mind. Instead, what I do is I filter out the noise of their ideology, and I zero in on what those potholes are, the trauma, the abuse, the poverty, the neglect, the even privilege. I mean, it could be anything. For me, it was abandonment. And what I do is I fill in those potholes. I help people become more resilient. Typically, grievance, some sort of grievance, leads somebody to extremist movements. So I try and build that resilience. And it's pretty amazing what happens when people feel more self-confident, that there's less of a need to blame the other. But I don't stop there. I always introduce people to the folks that they think that they hate, and I try and build empathy that way to destroy the demonization with humanization. So I've sat with Holocaust deniers and Holocaust survivors, Islamophobes and imams and Muslim families. And what happens every time is there's a connection, because in most cases, none of these folks have ever had a meaningful interaction or discussion with anybody that they think that they hate.
Because they don't know them, right? They've never met them.
That's correct. But that's correct. And most times they're isolated.
Nancy, I want to get you in on this as well as regional director of the Anti-Defamation League, in terms of helping people understand what might drive them to have some of these pernicious thoughts and to act out on them. But what Christian is describing is, it's one-on-one, it takes time, and I feel like as a country, we are feeling the need to do something now. I mean, the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over again, expecting some kind of different result. But what does the ADL do?
Well, we work in many different directions. Some of it is education of law enforcement, so they better understand what hate crimes are, about the various groups, their methodology, their backgrounds, what drives them, et cetera. Some of it is in schools. We are the largest anti-bias educator in the country. And so for instance, this week, educators. We have on our website lots of free curriculum, lots of table talk exercises, parent exercises. Talk to your children because they've heard this. They heard what happened. To ignore it lets others fill in the potholes, but not in a good way, for instance. So we go into schools, we work and do anti-bias education, we do diversity appreciation, because as Emil said, hate, you aren't born hating.
Right.
Hate is learned, and we have to help them make sure that as they grow up, that's not what happens.
How do you suggest that we think about addressing this kind of ideology, Emil?
Yeah, well, one is systemic through education. I completely agree that, I think there's a, if you just look at racism as an example, there's a tendency for, if you ask white people, what is racism about, they'll generally cite interpersonal racism, right? Treating somebody differently because of the color of their skin. Whereas if you ask someone who's black about racism, they'll generally cite systemic forms of racism. And I think this has to do with an ignorance of our history, that if you don't know about redlining, if you don't know about disparities in criminal justice, and job markets in, you know, where Social Security came from. If you don't know any of that history, you would think that systemic racism isn't really a thing, that it's that it was in the deep, deep, dark past. But it's here. And when you have a 20-to-1 disparity in wealth between the black community and the white community, you know, that gives rise to that's the systemic racism that drives a lot of this. So if we have an ignorance of that history, that's a problem. We might have the potential to preempt racism from happening. Since it has a developmental trajectory, we can at least try, and that's what we're doing now, mm-hmm. is to try to see what types of interventions we can implement among kindergartners and preschoolers to prevent them from becoming racist in the first place.
But do you think talking to a racist, I'm sort of speaking in broad terms here, mm-hmm. obviously knowing they're different kinds, to say, but what about redlining? I mean, to talk to them about something systemic, that actually might change their mind?
Well, I think this is educational, right? So this is for children to preempt racism, or maybe for older children to inoculate against racism. For adults that already have the racism, you have to unwind it somehow. And I think kind of a rule of thumb is that we want people to think, right? We want people to have a calculated view. And if you want people to think, the last thing you want to do is threaten them. If we feel threat, we're going to descend into a limbic response, right? A different set of brain regions than you want them thinking with if you want them thinking critically. So we are perfectly,
fight or flight,
exactly. We're perfectly comfortable thinking in those terms, thinking reflexively. But what we want to do is have people think mm-hmm. reflectively. And if you want people to reflect, you have to somehow challenge them without threatening them. You have to challenge their ideology without making them feel like their identity is being threatened. And this is something that Christian can do kind of intuitively. It's something that we might be able to do more deliberately and intentionally. And those are the types of interventions that I'm trying to explore as a scientist.
Christian, help us understand, first of all, the fact that we are talking about this right now. Does that for hate groups, are they pleased that we are having this conversation because we are talking about them? And when our political leaders make incendiary comments or even racist comments, does that inspire and even further cement hate groups' ideology?
Absolutely. 30 years ago, had we heard, you know, some of the same things we're hearing now come out of the administration, I would have been a very happy person. We would have reveled in the fact that we had our person in the White House. Everything from the nationalist comment to the Muslim ban to tearing families apart at the border. I mean, everything falls in line, and even the limitation of gender. Those are all things that were part of our agenda to try and see through. So, while I think that the optics right now, when a tragedy like this happens, there are certain members, maybe the marketeers who, you know, have to now take a step back and do some damage control. I think that what you'll see throughout, you know, these groups, whether it's online or just in person, is that they're applauding what happened.
Mm. Or being silent. You know, I mean, that's the other thing, is standing on the sidelines.
Or standing on the sidelines. But what I've noticed as well is that people who were white supremacists, who maybe got out of that movement on their own years ago or even recently, are now reaching out to me after what happened in Pittsburgh, because one of the reasons that they left was because they just could not reconcile the violence of the beliefs. And now that the violence is happening, now they're questioning their beliefs. So I've had quite a few people reach out to me just since yesterday saying, you know, I used to be like this, and I now want to speak out and say something.
Well, and Nancy, leaders can also stand up and address the country and deal with and address the deep sorrow, I think, that so many people have. I think worry about our country as well.
No question. But it's not enough for our leaders to speak out one paragraph worth, and then go back to doing what they were doing before. We've seen that over and over. We need our leaders to lead, from the president to the people in Congress, to the heads of corporations and companies and businesses and mayors, straight down the line. Everyone needs to do this. It's not enough to stop for 10 seconds and move back to where you were.
I mean, about a minute or so before our break here, and I mentioned the fact that, you know, we have been here before, as we know this. In certain ways, this is our history. Do we just have to accept it?
No, we have to learn it, right? The way to prevent repeating our history is to know about it. And I think the way to, you know, maybe transcend our psychology is also through awareness. So if we can understand these processes, if we can pull the curtain back and look at what Oz is doing to us in our own minds, maybe that can help us transcend some of this as well.
Well, let's take that short break and we'll get back to our conversation. That's Emile Bruneau, director of the Peace and Conflict Neuroscience Lab at the Annenberg School for Communication. That's at the University of Pennsylvania. He's a lead scientist of the Beyond Conflict Innovation Lab. Nancy Baron-Bear, also with us here in our Philadelphia studio. She's regional director of the Anti-Defamation League. And joining us from Chicago, from the studios of WBEZ, is Christian Piccellini, former extremist, and he's created several organizations to help counter-violent extremism, including Life After Hate and the Free Radicals Project. We want you to join our conversation. That phone number, 1-888-477-9499. Lots of comments here. I'll read after this short break. Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And do stay with us. Much more after the short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Barney Moss-Cohen. Let me read some comments, an email from Phyllis. She says, my feeling impression is that these perpetrators are almost competing for approval by President Trump and the alt-right leaders. They seek recognition in a very twisted way. An email from John, I'm very frustrated that some are still drawing a false equivalence between the far right and the far left. Since Timothy McVeigh has made made the right by far the most turned political, I'm losing my track here on the screen here. Anyway, concerned about the equivalence there. An email from Anna. Can someone please comment on the recent Trump proclamation that if the Republicans lose control of Congress, there will be violence in the streets? And I wonder if we could pick up on that. And Christian, I'll even go back to you. And I don't want to make this all about President Trump. And obviously, the people who carried out these violent acts are responsible for their own behavior, but this is a man who was a birther and a longstanding birther. He even was when he threw his hat in the ring in 2015. How do you see our president?
Wow, that's a complicated question that I'm not sure I'm equipped to answer on air. But here's my take: is, you know, I don't know what the man is personally, because he's changing every day, and it's hard to pin down. But all I can do is judge him on what the white supremacists think about him. They support him. They praise him. They love his policies. They stand behind him and they vote for him. And to me, that is you know, that tells me exactly what his values are. And you know, it tells me also that they're opposed to mine.
That they're opposed to yours. I don't want to get too out on a limb here, but I think we also have to recognize the kind of political environment that we're in, and he's not solely responsible for it, but nonetheless, he pushes and pushes.
Yeah, well, I think one of the interesting pieces of research that came out right after the election was how strongly authoritarians supported Trump. That if you looked at right-wing authoritarianism, which is a scale that was developed after World War II, right, to try to make sense of how so many Germans could follow the policies of Hitler. So that was created, you know, in the 1970s or 80s. And the degree to which people reported high on this right-wing authoritarianism scale was a really strong predictor of their support for Trump, but not their support for any other candidate. So, you know, authoritarians like to have a strong leader who talks tough. And so that's certainly an element going into it. And if you have authoritarians who also have a particular ideology, then you have a really dramatic followership.
Go ahead, Nancy.
I think one thing that seems different as we approach these elections is that white supremacist candidates are much more out there. They're out there in their own name. They're not hesitant in some regard to post about white supremacy and that the white race is superior. And that's a change. They would hide it before, and there weren't as many as we see today. So I think that there's that emboldenment, the word that people use over and over, the feeling that it's okay.
Mm. Christian, let me go back to you. When the word globalist is used, or even the name George Soros is used, how does that resonate among white supremacists and anti-Semites?
Well, it speaks directly to them. You know, we've all heard the term dog whistle, and frankly, having been involved in the movement, when I hear them, they're bullhorns to me. They speak right to who that person was 30 years ago. You know, and it goes back to what I said earlier about them taking their words and just making them more palatable to seem as though they're, you know, they're just political words. And what they've done is they've adopted these terms like globalist and demonizing people like George Soros to hide their anti-Semitism, because those words to them, you know, George Soros is you know, the Jew, quote unquote, pulling the strings. And the term globalist is, you know, somebody who wants to foster multiculturalism to promote a white cultural genocide.
Obviously, as an immigrant himself, a Jew, a foreigner, talk to us, Emil, about this caravan and why that has taken on such importance. It is about 1,000 miles away, as I understand it. We're talking about largely women and children trying to walk their way to the U.S. border to become refugees. But it has taken on this enormous meaning for so many people.
Well, unfortunately, psychology doesn't care about reality. Psychology only cares about perception. And, you know, from my previous research, it seems clear that people's perception of the caravan, even Democrats' perception of the caravan, is far more composed of children who are being used to get across the border, and far more composed of gang members than it actually is, right? Dramatically so. And so it may be true that the caravan is made up mostly of women and children who are refugees trying to flee violence and crime, but that's not the perception that's driving people's psychology. People feel threatened by this, both a symbolic threat to our way of life in the U.S. This is often referenced just like it was in Hungary, but also, you know, this very real threat of inflating in the news, either when you're denouncing it or when you're supporting it, inflating the instances of gang members who are harming Americans, right? The reality is that immigrants are far less violent than native-born Americans, and they're harder working, right? And they're more productive. Communities with more immigrants, the other people in the community make more money, right? So immigrants is how the U.S. drives as an economic engine. But again, those aren't the stories that are prominent in our minds, right? The availability heuristic, right? The available news out there is about gang members and children being used.
Well, and I'm thinking, Nancy, about HIAS. This is this organization that began more than 100 years ago helping Jews. Now they help people from all over the world. But that's also been part of this whole conspiracy theory.
Correct. Absolutely. You know, it's interesting. I think it also feeds into the word white supremacy was made because there was a belief that they were supreme. They were the best. And over time, since the 1960s, it has their power kind of went down and down. And now it's not a question of supremacy. Mm. It's a question of mere existence. And so when you see a caravan and you hear these words about the caravan and it's just more people coming in to dilute the white race, then that emboldens all the people that are involved in this movement. It's also like there's been a much increased number of flyerings and packet droppings on people's lawn by the KKK local groups, and people in the neighborhoods around Philly have been quite worried. But the truth of the matter is that it's not an increase in their numbers. It's a desperate attempt on their part to keep some kind of relevance and supremacy by putting their little notes in baskets, in baggies, and dropping it on the lawn.
Well, and Christian, I'm thinking of the Charlottesville rally where the white supremacists were chanting, you know, "We will not be replaced." Is that, and we are becoming a more diverse country. There's absolutely no question about that. Are we seeing in a way the last gasp, or just a level of desperation that might not have been there before?
I actually don't agree with the last gasp. I do see it growing very rapidly, and the internet provided a lot of fuel to that. It used to be that, in my day and age, that you had to get a book or a pamphlet or somebody had to come speak to you in person. And unfortunately now, the internet has become a place where it's very, very easy to stumble on this propaganda, this conspiracy theory, and this narrative. And it's become, in my experience from the work that I do, one of the fastest growing social movements around. And it's troubling. But one thing I want to be clear about is, everything that a white supremacist says or an extremist is based on lies. And there's nothing that they can say that is true. It's wrapped in some truth. It's wrapped in free speech or in some sort of a narrative that's difficult to argue with. But the basis of everything that they say is a falsehood. It is their job to create fear and to create the conditions that keep us afraid. That's their lifeblood. It's their livelihood. And that's what they're doing now.
And Emil, this is global.
Yeah, it's global, but also, strangely, this is the thing that gives me the most hope, because their ideology is based on lies and inconsistencies. And that at least gives us a potential lever. I think my job and scientists' job is to figure out how we can correct those most effectively, how you can challenge somebody without making them feel threatened so that they can, they can critically evaluate those views that they hold.
An email from Marisol says, "Isn't it possible that some people or some groups simply enjoy what it means to hate and therefore look for excuses to engage in hate behavior?" Nancy, I'm going to put that to you. Do you think there is some perverse satisfaction in hating other people?
I hope not. It's hard for me to answer that question, but I certainly hope not. I hope that the feelings one gets from a positive community, which, as Christian said, unfortunately, some of these people don't have a community. They don't have a place to go. And it's because of that that they take on these attributes and it goes into hatred. So we need to help them find a community that's more positive.
Cesar Sayak, the man who allegedly sent all those pipe bombs last week, his lawyer was quoted as saying about him, "He had tremendous anger slowly boiling up and resentment and felt less than. He lacked an identity. He created a persona." And in many ways, that's sort of what we've been talking about during this hour.
Yeah, there's this concept in psychology that I think is really useful now, which is meta perceptions. It's what you think other groups think of you. And we've found in a number of different contexts that the negativity of your meta perceptions can drive how you behave towards the other group. So the degree to which Americans thought that Iranians dehumanized us was a strong predictor of whether people opposed the nuclear arms deal with Iran and whether they endorsed war with Iran. So this is another tool that I don't know, Christian can perhaps speak to this, but
sure.
I wonder if this appears also on the net of how the other group is thinking of us.
Can you take that, Christian?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that there's a certain degree of, both sides feeding each other. The more extreme parts of either camp feeding each other, mm-hmm. Both with fear. So, we are seeing a lot of, far leftist and far right, interaction, and they seem to be fueling each other's hatred for each other. And that's concerning. However, I'm not making an equivalency between, the activists on the left and folks who walk into a synagogue and murder 11 innocent people. I think that there's a vast difference. One of my biggest concerns right now is the way we're focusing, especially law enforcement and folks in government are focusing on the left as being, the terrorists, as being the folks who are stirring the pot when it's not true, because it's a reactionary movement. And I don't agree with the left and violence. But certainly, it's a reactionary movement to what white supremacists are doing right now.
Do you agree with that, Nancy?
Well, the fact is, if we're dealing here in facts, that close to 80% of the extremist-related murders in the last decade were performed by white supremacists. They weren't performed by Islamic extremists or leftists or right, they were white supremacists, and that's a very high percentage.
And we should underscore that what happened yesterday was the deadliest attack on Jews in America.
Yes,
as according to the ADL. Some more comments. A comment from Steve: the president is the number one fomenter of hatred and violence at this moment. An email from Tommy: President Trump has encouraged and suggested violent acts. An email from John: why do you think there's no fear in regards to consequences of these kinds of violent actions? Can I just that to you, Emil? The three alleged perpetrators are arrested, and two of them, I believe, are going to be in court today. But is there a sense of getting away with it?
I don't know. Maybe the psychological benefits are greater than the physical costs. Once you're bought into the ideology, it seems like you feel righteous in what you do. It's not that you're making some – well, it is that you're making some great sacrifice, but you're doing it for a reason.
Right.
Right? Your life has purpose, as Christian mentioned. This is one of the things that drives people into these movements is – if they don't feel purpose in their life and they don't feel social identity, white supremacy gives them both. And an action like this only amplifies that.
Well, and another big question, question to you, Christian, but we are a country that allows people to say horrible things. There's no question. And, of course, the Internet can amplify that. How do we reconcile hateful speech and hate crimes?
Well, currently we don't have an online hate crime law, and certainly people can be terrorized online the same way they can in real life. And it's something that I think we need to think about in our current environment. Mm-hmm. I used to think that limiting speech was the answer, and frankly, I think that we need more knowledge. We need more speech to combat it. We need to make sure that the children growing up in our society and future generations understand the things that this country has dealt with, that we acknowledge the Holocaust that happened here on our own soil, that we understand the impact of the Holocaust that happened in during World War II, that we understand the impact of humanity. And when we hurt each other, that it isn't just somebody hurting a nameless, faceless person. I really do think that we need to inoculate the population from this for generations coming.
And we're almost out of time, but Nancy, it looks like you want to say something.
But there are practical things that we can do, too. In other words, all of these service providers have terms of service. And when we see something that doesn't appear right, we need to say something. Same with we need to be allies in schools and communities and stand up for those that are bullied.
Nancy Baron-Bear, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times. And Emil Bruneau, thank you for coming in and joining us as well. And Christian Piccellini, thank you for joining us from WBEZ in Chicago. My thanks to all three of you for a very important conversation. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about the program. And again, I posted a TED Talk that Christian gave a couple of years ago, and we put that on our Facebook page. You can listen and comment on that as well. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Bilder, John Ahrens, and Alex Stern. I'm Marty Moscoe. Thank you for joining us.